I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. After World War II, chicken farmers were worried that Americans would start eating pork and beef again that had been rationed and reduce their consumption of poultry. So the supermarket A&P organized the Chicken of Tomorrow contest, using science and technology to create a big-breasted bird that would be profitable and popular. Here's a clip from a 1948 documentary about the project hosted by broadcaster Lowell Thomas.
Did you know that poultry is the nation's third largest agricultural crop, a $3 billion business? Yes, chickens are raised in every county of the United States, mostly for egg production. Breeders have achieved great results in boosting the egg output of the average hen. Today's hen averages 154 eggs per year.
The project was incredibly successful, and today Americans consume almost 100 pounds of chicken a year. Our guest Andrew Lawler writes about this in his new book, How the Chicken Crossed the World. He also traces the fowl's evolution from royal bird to today's industrial chicken farms. He's a contributing writer for Science Magazine, a contributing editor for Archaeology Magazine, and he joins us from the studios of WCQS in Asheville. Andrew Lawler, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. It's a pleasure.
Nice to have you here. I never thought I'd be so fascinated by a chicken. So thank you for writing this book. You describe the chicken as the Mr. Potato Head of animals. Describe what you mean by that.
Well, all domesticated animals have a wild predecessor, and the chicken's wild ancestor is the red jungle fowl. And the strange thing is that it's a very, very shy creature that lives in the jungles of Southeast Asia. And so I was fascinated by this question of how this very shy bird became the quintessential barnyard fowl. And what's really clear is that this bird, unlike so many other animals, has an incredible ability to change shape, to morph into whatever it is we want that chicken to be for us.
Well, and as you describe, very malleable, and certainly science and technology having a lot to do with that. Let me just ask you a couple of questions about some of the early days of the chicken. You describe this grand entrance in Thebes, a really royal parade or procession featuring chickens. Take us back to that time.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine the chicken attracting much attention in a parade today. But in ancient Egypt, this was really exciting. The pharaoh of the time, Thutmose III, had gone to Mesopotamia on a campaign against today's Iraq. And when he came back, he brought tribute. And not only did he bring the sons of foreign princes and elephants and all kinds of strange and exotic foods, as well as minerals and beautiful jewelry, he also brought chickens. And these were the first chickens, as far as we know, that appeared in ancient Egypt. And they were so special that he actually had carved on the Temple of Karnak a note that, and by the way, we also brought back from the land of Mesopotamia a bird that lays every day, which is a pretty good description of the chicken.
And what did this chicken look like?
Well, the chickens of that day were probably, by our standards, pretty scrawny creatures. But the males are actually quite colorful and probably looked very similar to the red jungle fowl that we see today, that is the wild predecessor of the domestic chicken. So it was a very colorful bird, like a pheasant, and probably its feathers were highly prized by people to use for decoration. And the thing crowed every morning before dawn, and this was an unusual thing. Most birds don't do that. So the bird attracted a lot of attention, but it was mostly just a plaything of the rich for the first millennia or two.
You say really the cock's comb has a lot to do, or looks a lot like the royal crown that we see kings and queens wearing.
Yes, the ancient Persians held the chicken, or the rooster in particular, in high esteem. And part of the reason may be that they believed that this bird was crowned and looked royal. And so a lot of royals, even up to the time of Queen Victoria, viewed the chicken as a very royal bird that was deserving of an important place in their menageries.
It's also interesting to think of the chicken as an animal that has gotten sacrificed, for instance, in religious rituals.
Yes. In fact, this is one of the unusual things I found, that all over the world, even today, the chicken is really your go-to bird for ritual sacrifice. It's small, and it is not like sacrificing a cow, which can be quite expensive and even a little on the messy side. But chickens were always considered to be a messenger between heaven and earth. And this includes the traditions from ancient China to ancient Greece and ancient Persia to the Romans, right up to the people who practice Santeria, the African Caribbean rituals, religion that you find in parts of the South and in Cuba.
You say an interesting thing about the chicken, that we often credit the horse and the dog helping to civilize the world, and they certainly played a part. But you say that the chicken really played a maybe larger part or a really unheralded part in the civilization of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. They're so small, they kind of go unremarked upon. But I was amazed by how many books have been written about horses and dogs and cats, but very little has been written about the chicken. And part of this is that the chicken, as we mentioned earlier, is so malleable. So it's been used for religious purposes. It's been used, of course, for meat and eggs. It's also been used for entertainment, like cockfighting, which was one of the most important sports and most popular sports around the world until fairly recently. So it's also used for medicinal purposes. We all probably have had our chicken soup when we have a cold, and science shows that, in fact, chicken soup can suppress the symptoms of a cold. So the chicken has so many different uses that you don't find with other domesticated animals. It can be used for almost anything, and humans have used them for almost anything over the ages.
And did you write this book to give the chicken its due?
Well, I didn't come at this trying to pump the chicken up. I was actually kind of drawn into this because of my interest in archaeology and the spread of civilization around the world and how that happened. And what I discovered was anywhere you found civilization, particularly in Asia and Africa and Europe, the chicken showed up pretty quickly. So the chicken has, for a lot of archaeologists, become a marker for how a complex society develops. If people have chickens, they probably are agriculturalists and they probably have a pretty stable society. So the chickens are used around the world today by archaeologists to understand more about how our ancestors lived.
Let's talk a bit about the role that Queen Victoria played in the evolution of the chicken that we probably would recognize today. Why was she so interested in this bird?
Queen Victoria was, as many people may know, was an animal lover. She had lots of dogs and all kinds of animals. What I found surprising is that her gift, she received a gift of 5 or 6 exotic chickens from China. This is during the time of the Opium Wars, when China, for the first time, has opened up to the world. And these were really unusual-looking chickens. They were very large. They had feathers that almost looked like fur, and they created a sensation. Victoria was entranced. She had an aviary built there at Windsor Castle, and soon the newspapers picked up on the story, and everybody wanted to collect these exotic chickens. So more than any single individual, Queen Victoria was the person who really laid the foundation for the modern chicken we know today.
Did she eat chickens as well?
She did. She was not a vegetarian, but primarily she used these chickens to raise and to show. She sent them off to shows to win awards. And soon in England, this is in the 1840s, these chickens became hot property. They became like the tulips of 16th century Holland. People were collecting them and paying vast sums in order to have the latest exotic chicken to show off to their friends. So Victoria started this trend, created this fad, and the fad, of course, as fads do, lasted maybe a few years, and then after a while, it no longer people decided that it was no longer worthwhile to spend that money on chickens. But in the meantime, what happened was Charles Darwin became interested in chickens as a result of all the talk about these exotic chickens from around the world, and he actually used the chicken to develop his theory of evolution.
And that's our guest, Andrew Lawler. We are talking about chickens in this hour of Radio Times. He's the author of a new book called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. And if you want to join our conversation, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Well, let's talk about the New World or America. How did the chicken get to the Americas?
Well, of course, chickens are not native to the Americas as far as we know, but there is some evidence that they were here even before Columbus. Columbus brought chickens on his first expeditions, but there's some hints that chickens may have come from the other side of the world. That is, Polynesians traveling across the Pacific Ocean may have brought the chicken to South America. So a chicken bone that was recently found on the coast of Chile is causing a bit of an uproar in the scientific community because some researchers claim that it actually is earlier than Columbus. Therefore, it must have come from the Polynesians. The debate's still raging, but here's another example where the chicken can tell us something about humans.
Well, also, Africans raised chickens as well, and as slaves were brought over to the United States, they were allowed to raise chickens in this country because they were seen as, I guess, sort of lesser food.
Yeah, certainly farmers of the day were primarily focused on pigs and cattle and other large animals. And the chicken was not considered to be that important, particularly in colonial times. There was a lot of wild game here in the United States at the time. So there was no real need to focus on the chicken. So chickens weren't even really considered significant whatsoever. So slave owners thought it was fine to allow slaves to raise a few chickens. What harm could come from that? They could help feed themselves, reduce the costs that the masters would pay to feed their slaves, and they were allowed to sell chickens. And as a result of this, slaves were able to actually create a business around selling and buying chickens. And this is really important because it was one of the only avenues that African Americans had at that time to practice an entrepreneurial spirit, because they could actually sell their chickens for money to their masters and to other masters and thereby have at least a little bit of spending money.
You talk about Thomas Jefferson and his slaves and chickens.
Yes. When he was president of the United States in the early 1800s, his granddaughter was left in charge of Monticello, his plantation, and he made sure that she wrote down every single transaction. And one of the interesting things I discovered was that every single slave at Monticello, with the exception of the cooks and Sally Hemings, who was Jefferson's mistress, at some point sold chicken meat or chicken eggs to the household. So that gives you a sense of the business that was going on. And African Americans specialized in this. They had an edge over the other people in the country at the time because they came from West Africa, an area where the chicken had long been used as part of not just of the culinary traditions, but also of religious traditions. So they were very familiar with how to take care of chickens and how to breed them and sell them.
We are talking about chickens in this hour of Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Our guest is Andrew Lawler. He's a contributing writer for Science Magazine, also contributing editor for Archaeology Magazine. And we're talking about his new book. It's called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers the Civilization. We are walking or talking through this history. We'll be talking a bit more about what happened to chickens after this Chicken of Tomorrow contest that was held after World War II and the role that science and technology has played in the development of today's chicken. Stay with us. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and here are some fun facts about chickens and eggs. More than 20 billion chickens live on our planet today. That's three chickens for every person. Mexicans eat more than 400 eggs per year. That's about three times the global average. Americans eat more than 80 pounds of chicken a year. That's four times the world average and more than any other country. And again, talking with our guest, Andrew Lawler, author of a book called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? Andrew, it sounds the way you write that the chicken raising or the tending of chickens was really or largely women's work. True.
Yes, until quite recently, actually, chickens were left to the wives of farmers. You know, real men, real farmers. They had pigs or cattle or grew cotton or corn, and chickens were considered beneath their notice. And this continued, and actually it benefited women because in the late 1800s, as the cities began to grow in the north, particularly in the Midwest and the South, which are often places of great, great poverty in this country, women started to notice that there was a demand, not just for chicken meat, but primarily for chicken eggs. So they got together, they learned how to use the railroads to ship eggs, fresh eggs, to the north. And this provided them with money, which for many of them was their only source of income, particularly if they lived on a small, very remote farm in the South. So chickens actually helped to provide some measure of financial independence for women so they could go into town, maybe buy a few things, and they weren't subject to their husband's income and had a little flexibility there. So this actually benefited women quite a bit well into the 1920s. In fact, the broiler industry was begun by a woman who lived in Delaware on a farm.
Well, in fact, the Delmarva Peninsula, as you write, in the early 20th century, that became a place where people raised chickens. It's still true today. Why do you think that particular geography?
Well, partly it's because Celia Steele, the woman that I mentioned, lived in Delaware, and she was sent 50 eggs and hatched them and was going to just raise them for eggs. But by accident, she was sent 500 and didn't know what to do with them all. So instead, she raised them and then shipped them to New York. New York is actually quite close to the Delmarva Peninsula, which includes Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. Right. So it was easy. It was cheap land, easy transport, very fertile area. It was easy to grow the feed for the chickens. And so this became a booming business in Delmarva in the 1920s and 1930s, right into World War II.
Well, I played that clip from The Chicken of Tomorrow, which, you know, just sounds so 1948 to my ears. And this was really an effort to after World War II, to ensure that the American public continued to consume chickens. Who was behind this effort?
Well, first of all, remember that at that time, most Americans didn't eat much chicken. Before World War II, chicken was definitely low on the totem pole of the kind of meat you wanted to put on your table. Chickens tended to be a little on the scrawny side. They were expensive. It was much, much cheaper to go with other meats that were more popular. So when World War II took place, as you mentioned earlier, the chicken became more accessible and actually one of the few meats that people, civilians, could eat because the pork and beef were sent mainly to the troops. So at the end of the war, the industry was terrified. They thought, oh my God, when the war is over, people are going to go back to eating pork and beef. And our chicken business, which was really booming during the war, is going to tank. So they had to come up with a solution. And that solution was the Chicken of Tomorrow Project. Mm. So they got everybody in the United States who wanted to involved in this. It was a big media campaign. Lowell Thomas, as we heard earlier, was involved. He was paid to produce the show that was put out all around the country in newsreels and in movie theaters. This was a very big deal. And when finally the award was made, it was the Vice President of the United States who made the award at a very large stadium in Arkansas. It was the Chicken of Tomorrow's kind of final moment, and today we're still living with that bird.
And that's the start of these big-breasted chickens that we see today.
Yes, absolutely. That chicken is the chicken that we eat today. Probably 95 or even more percent of the chicken that you find in any restaurant in this country, from a McDonald's to the fanciest Manhattan restaurant to the birds that you would buy, whether it's Perdue or Tyson in the supermarket, is a direct descendant of this chicken of tomorrow, with its large breast and fairly tasteless meat. That's the reason why we have to spend all that time marinating and rubbing and doing all of that so that this meat actually has a little bit of flavor.
You even say this Chicken of Tomorrow contest that was held was not unlike the Manhattan Project of the time, using, I guess, what, science and technology to build this better bird?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, until World War II, disease was a big threat to chickens. We really didn't understand the nutritional needs of chickens. And with advances in science and engineering, these kinds of techniques were brought to bear to create a chicken that would fatten up very, very quickly and would require less in the way of Sunshine, for example, they could be grown indoors under artificial lights, and the feed was brought right to them. They didn't have to root around for insects in a barnyard. So it was a very, very efficient system.
Well, and it's sort of shocking to see how that rate of growth was speeded up, I guess, through breeding, through nutrition, use of things like antibiotics. It's really kind of breathtaking when you think about it.
There is no other animal on Earth that has ever been as engineered as the chicken. It's astonishing to see how we have intervened. And partly that's because, as we began with, the chicken is so incredibly malleable. Yeah. It can alter and change itself to suit our purposes. So the Chicken of Tomorrow contest really changed the game and turned this bird into a meat-producing and egg-producing machine.
You describe, I guess, before this Chicken of Tomorrow contest, the average flock was something like 200 chickens. Shortly after that, 10,000 chickens, as much as 100,000 chickens, and of course, I guess, leading inevitably to the kind of industrial poultry farming that we see today.
Yes, absolutely. And it's not just the numbers. It's also the way in which the business is organized. Remember that pigs and cattle were raised by farmers who would then sell them to a middleman who would then sell them generally to some other distribution system, and so they would get to people in city markets. But the chicken, actually, because the industry is actually relatively new, companies like Tyson were able to tie together the entire process so that from even before the hatching of the egg until the bird reaches the supermarket, one company can control almost all of that. Mm-hmm. And farmers in this system become basically contractors. They're given a chicken, they raise it, and then they pass it on in this process. This is called vertical integration, and it's revolutionized the way that the meat industry operates.
You mentioned Tyson and Perdue, Frank Perdue, John Tyson, really taking, as you describe it, a very sort of business person's approach to raising chickens. It's not like they have any particular affection for the bird.
No, it's very different from, say, the cattle industry, where, you know, Texas ranchers are very proud of their particular breeds and, you know, get out there on the farm and like to show that they're people of the land. The chicken business is very much a coat and tie industrial business.
That's Andrew Lawler, and we are talking about chickens in this hour of Radio Times. He's written a new book called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World?, subtitled The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. We have been talking about some of that history and talking about current production practices in the United States. He is a contributing writer for Science Magazine, a contributing editor for Archaeology Magazine. And again, any questions or comments that you might have about chickens, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coain. You describe, this is more current day, something like 300 hatcheries in the United States produce 9 billion, that's with a B, broiler chickens. This goes back a couple of years to, 2010, 2014. I don't know if those numbers are even bigger, but I'm just trying to do the math in my head. From 300 hatcheries, 9 billion broiler chicks.
Yes, it's a very centralized business. And when you buy a chicken, even if you're somebody who wants to buy a backyard chicken, the odds are you're buying it from a very large company, one of the very few. There are only a small handful of companies that actually produce chickens these days. And they even come in model numbers. They're very much like buying a car. So if you buy a backyard chicken, often these companies have developed a chicken that will suit your needs. So it's pretty astonishing to see the extent of the engineering that's involved with the chicken.
How did the Ozarks, I guess, or the sort of middle part of the country, how did that become a place where I guess chickens are slaughtered?
Well, there's a one-word answer for that, and that is Tyson. Tyson was a truck driver during the Depression and was looking for a way to make ends meet. He was really very quite poor, couldn't put food on the table, and so he began to transport chickens. So there were a few chicken farms in the Ozarks, and he would drive to places like Chicago and sell these birds and then come back for another load. And he discovered that being the middleman was actually quite profitable. And so he helped to develop that business. And folks in the Ozarks, who were quite poor during the Depression, began to realize that the chickens were a business that could really help them.
I'm quoting from your book here. You say more than half of the nation's 250,000 poultry workers are women, 50% are Latino, and an estimated 1 in 5 is an illegal immigrant. It is often ugly, low-paid, and dangerous work, as is well documented, and you go on from there. But just to sort of underscore that part of this creation of this chicken that many people eat today.
There's an irony associated with the business today, and that is that women and African Americans are so critical to the development of the modern chicken, and yet today we find that they're the ones who are doing this really low-paid and often quite dangerous work.
Talk about the Senate Chicken Caucus. I didn't know we had one of those.
Indeed. Well, there's a National Chicken Council in Washington. Should come as no surprise.
Right.
They like to lobby like everybody else. And this, part of the reason why the Chicken Council has been so successful is that this is a multi-billion-dollar business spread across a number of very important states. And so if there's any attempt at introducing chicken legislation, you can bet the National Chicken Council will be involved. That's their job. They represent more than 90% of the chicken industry.
You described and mentioned earlier the cockfighting, and you actually witnessed some of that. Describe for our listeners what you saw.
Well, I decided, since I'd never seen a cockfight when I began to work on this book, that it was probably made sense just to go right to the top. So I found the Super Bowl of cockfighting, and that was in Manila. It was called the World Slasher Cup, and went and spent several days there and watched a number of these 648 cockfights that took place in this Coliseum. And really what I discovered is it's really about gambling, that in countries that don't have a tradition of kind of Las Vegas gambling, kind of modern gambling, that cockfighting is the way that people did it in traditional societies, with very few exceptions. So still in the Philippines, it's legal, and people there are very proud of the fact that they have this ancient tradition that is so different from the kind of soulless gambling that you find. And one cockfighter remarked to me that, you know, hey, this is a lot better. You have a 50-50 chance of winning, and you immediately, you know, you get your money or you give your money, and you can walk away at any time. So, you know, they did have a point, but of course there's great carnage that takes place, and there's one winner and one loser, and that loser ends up dead.
You witnessed that?
Yes, and I have to say, at first I didn't know how I was going to react to it. And at first it was disconcerting. They had large screens there. You could see it all from close up in this Coliseum.
Wow.
And then after a while, I have to admit that I started to think, which one's going to win?
Oh, really?
So it was amazing. It was amazing to see how quickly I could get into the game with thousands of people screaming and yelling. It was quite a bit of energy, quite a bit of machismo in a place like that.
Well, you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. We have, Andrew, a comment from Diane from Center City. She says a lot of people are raising rare breeds of chicken purely for show. There are a lot of rare breeds of chickens out there. This is, I guess, the other part of the chicken story.
Yeah, certainly there's
backyard been chickens that are kind of making a comeback.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a wonderful resurgence in traditional chickens. Now, when you talk about ancient chickens or heritage chickens, really you're talking about the chickens that were developed in the late 1800s, thanks to Queen Victoria and others. We don't have chickens that go back much further than that, at least in the West. There are some more ancient chickens in places like Vietnam. Lots of heritage breeds there that are very, very interesting and beautiful and quite varied. But most of the backyard chickens in the U.S. Come from companies that design them. They aren't necessarily heritage breeds, even if they aren't your typical Rhode Island hen.
Let me see what Harold from Wallingford, Pennsylvania has to say. Harold, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I ran across a recipe for something called a Cornell chicken, and best I could tell, it seemed to have come out of a laboratory at the university, and I wondered if your guest had any comments on it.
Let's find out, Harold. Thanks for the call. Andrew Lawler, any answer?
Well, I do know that that Cornell University in New York does have what is considered one of the best poultry science departments in the country, and that for the past 100 years, they have been one of the leaders in engineering chickens. I don't know about this particular recipe. I'll have to look it up.
Harold, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Andrew, you met and actually visited a woman named Karen Davis, founder of an animal rights organization. This is, I guess it's called United Poultry Concerns. What are her concerns?
Well, I have to say I was really affected by what she's doing. Karen Davis, she has a farm out on the Delmarva Peninsula, right in the heart of the poultry business there. And what she does is she takes in chickens that have been abandoned or chickens that have been abused, and she keeps them and takes care of them. And she gave me a little tour, and at first I was very skeptical. In my mind, I dismissed her as perhaps an animal rights person who didn't really care much about people. And I had a lot of ideas. But once she took me on this tour, she really opened my eyes to the nature of this modern chicken and the fact that they actually are genetically designed to suffer in order to produce more meat. And that was really disturbing.
Well, and we're going to be picking up on that with our second guest waiting in the wings. But we're talking about, you know, chickens with these large breasts that really can't hold themselves up because their skeleton isn't really designed for this large chest area.
They can grow so large that their legs break, and then they can't make it even to the feed dish.
Wow.
So it doesn't always happen, but that is something that is relatively common. So what I think I found most disturbing is that the chicken, unlike almost any other animal that we eat, is legally in the United States not considered an animal. It actually, if you raise it for food, there are no animal welfare standards that apply to chickens, which I find very peculiar.
Indeed. And we're almost out of time here. I just want to read the words on Karen Davis's T-shirt because I think it's so fantastic. She says, "I dream of a society where a chicken can cross the road without its motives being questioned."
That's pure Karen Davis.
That's the way she thinks and talks?
Absolutely. Well, what she made me see was that chickens have incredible personalities, that they actually are quite intelligent, and that they have a connection with humans that I think is borne out by my research, that humans and chickens have this dance that has been going on for millennia, and every society has used the chicken in a different way, and we're using it in one way. And it's nice to see people waking up to the intelligence of these birds.
Well, Andrew Lawler, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It was a pleasure, Marty.
A pleasure for us as well. The book is Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation about chickens, but with Dan Charles, who covers food and farming for NPR. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The average American eats close to 100 pounds of chicken a year. There are three times as many chickens as people on the earth. But the fowl didn't always play such a central role in dinner or in the world's food supply. In fact, for most of civilization, chickens were valued more in religion, in sport, medicine, even fashion than on our plates. And I was just talking with Andrew Lawler about the history of the chicken, from the shy bird of the South Asian jungle to the domesticated, plumped-up poultry in today's factory farms. His book called Why Did the Chicken Cross the Road? And joining us now is Dan Charles. He's NPR food and farming correspondent, and we're going to talk more about some modern chicken raising controversies. And Dan Charles, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
I wanted to ask you about something that was written a couple of days ago. This is this controversy about a chicken farmer named Craig Watts. He's a North Carolina chicken farmer, raises almost 750,000 chickens a year for Purdue. And there was a video made by Compassion and World Farming, which I looked at this morning, talking about the conditions of his particular farm. Have you seen that video? And do you have comments about this controversy?
Well, I have seen the video. I visited Craig Watts' farm, actually. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't.
For some stories I did earlier this year. So Craig Watts, he lives down in North Carolina, kind of right by the border with South Carolina. And I visited him because he's been a longstanding critic of the sort of the economic arrangement that's typical in the poultry industry. The so-called contract farming system. When I visited him, I went out to his chicken houses and we looked around and so forth. He didn't talk to me about animal welfare issues when I visited him. But apparently since that time, he's been in touch with this animal welfare group and invited them in to videotape in the houses. I actually don't feel comfortable really commenting on conditions in the houses as revealed in that video because, you know, it's an edited video. Who knows what the big picture looks like? But what the video shows is clearly, you know, animals that are in bad shape. You know, there's a chicken with a broken leg. There's chickens with their breasts kind of scraped raw. Some that are laying on the floor, sort of struggling to breathe. But what does it mean? Does that represent the typical state of the chicken in the house? You can't say that from that video. So since then, there's been this kind of back and forth. Purdue, which is the company that owns the chickens that Craig Watts raises, they issued a press release saying those are not conditions that are responsible, sort of animal treatment. And we're going to audit Craig Watts.
Oh, wow.
So they're basically saying this is bad management. We'll see what comes of that.
Well, let me pick up on something you said, and actually our earlier guest talked about it as well, this contracting farming system. So the farmer, owns the chicken house, but the poultry companies essentially own the eggs, the chicks, the chickens, and then provides the feed, the additives, and everything like that?
Right. Basically, the way what you described is accurate. The farmer builds the houses, owns the houses, owns the land. Typically, they'll take out a big loan to finance that. The chickens come in on big trucks. They are owned and delivered by, you know, what's called the integrator, the big company. You know, that could be Purdue in the case of Craig Watts. It could be Tyson. It could be Sanderson Farms. They deliver the chickens. They deliver the feed. The farmer is responsible for basically maintaining the operation. And then at a certain point in time, when they figure the chickens are ready to be, you know, sort of ready to go, then the company comes in, loads up the chickens, takes them away, and the farmer gets a check based on the amount of weight that they gained. But the company that delivers the chickens and, you know, really controls the operation. And so a lot of farmers, you know, complain about the imbalance in power. They say, we have to take whatever chicks they give us. Who knows what might have happened in the hatchery? Are we getting a good load? Are we getting a bad load? You know, are they giving us good feed, bad feed? We don't know, but we get paid based on, you know, whatever comes out the other end.
When you go to the supermarket, if you're looking at either chickens or eggs, you see, you know, raised, cage-free or humanely raised or some version of those words. What are we supposed to make of that, Dan Charles?
Well, first of all, cage-free applies to egg production, not poultry meat production. The typical arrangement for producing eggs, the chickens are in these long cages. If you're growing chickens for meat, they're typically running around on the floor in a big long house. So cage-free in the case of eggs means the chickens are running around on the floor typically, not necessarily outside. Typically, they're in a big building. Humanely raised, there are some organizations that certify, you know, different sort of humane standards. But it basically means, you know, they're getting enough to eat and they're not being mistreated. But, you know, I don't think there's anything more specific than that.
It's interesting. Our guest, Andrew Lawler, wrote this book, Why Did the Chicken Cross the World, about the evolution of the chicken. But he says the chickens raised for food are not considered animals under U.S. law, not subjected to any regulations on humane treatment. Can you speak to that at all?
Well, it's true. There are a couple of different laws that have been passed on different categories of animals. And I think the one that he's really specifically referring to is really aimed at cattle. And so it specifically exempted chickens, you know, from these sort of humane standards. I think it's stretching a little bit to say they're not considered animals. But yeah, for the purposes of that law, the animals that were covered in that law specifically exempted chickens. So yeah, there's no particular sort of law that anybody raising chickens has to abide by. When it comes to treating the animals.
And that's, yes, we are talking about chickens in this hour of Radio Time. Stan Charles, our second guest, he covers food and farming for NPR. If you have any questions or comments for us, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Dan Charles, you have written, or actually I should say have reported on the fact the use or misuse or now maybe less use of antibiotics in raising chickens. In fact, a school district in Los Angeles, they are saying they're no longer going to buy chickens that have been raised with antibiotics. Is there a kind of a pushback on the use of antibiotics in chicken raising?
Yeah, there is. I mean, if you go to the store, you'll see some chickens with a label on the package, some chicken meat with labels on the package saying raised without antibiotics or no antibiotics ever, I think, is the one that Purdue uses. Basically, I think people are generally aware of this. Antibiotics have been heavily used in animal agriculture. For instance, and they're used in sort of three different ways. The one is, as you would expect, you know, an animal gets sick or a whole house of chickens seems to be getting sick. Mm-hmm. Antibiotics will be used to treat the illness. They're also used in the case of chickens. There's particular kinds of antibiotics that are used to prevent a disease called coccidiosis. That particular class of antibiotics is not used in human medicine, and so people consider it maybe, you know, less worrisome, but still, you know, it's an antibiotic. And then there have also been antibiotics used for the purposes of making the animals grow a little faster. And there's been increasing concern about this, not so much because there's antibiotic residues in the meat. That's not really the concern. Meat is antibiotic-free, at least it's supposed to be. There's not supposed to be residues in there, although every once in a while they do catch some. But the concern is the more you use an antibiotic, this is true, you know, with us too, the more you use an antibiotic, the more likely it is that bacteria will develop resistance to the antibiotic. So the antibiotic isn't useful anymore. And so the fear is, and there's, you know, some good reasons for worrying about this, is the more you use antibiotic in kind of a routine way in agriculture, the more bacteria within the animal, within the chicken, will become resistant to that antibiotic. And then, you know, bacteria can migrate, right? And then if that gene, that resistance gene, or those bacteria end up infecting people, then those antibiotics won't work as well or at all anymore. So there's been this big push, you know, dial back the use of antibiotics in agriculture. And now these school districts have kind of signed on to this. It's L.A., actually half a dozen big city school districts, including New York City, have said in the future, we will demand that the chicken meat we buy be raised without the use of antibiotics.
Is this also coming from public health officials thinking, you know, the overuse of antibiotics by human beings is not a good thing either?
Right. Right. No, the agency that has kind of been in the lead in kind of raising the concern is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Mm-hmm. They have issued reports saying antibiotic resistance is a huge problem. Some part of that, you know, we think could be due to the use of antibiotics in farming. And so we want to, mm-hmm. you know, try to use them more judiciously. And the FDA is taking some steps, too, at least getting rid of the uses that are specifically to make the animals grow faster.
In fact, you say some, maybe it's Purdue or some of the other chicken farmers or raisers, I'm not even sure what word to use to describe, who grows our chickens using probiotics, which is an interesting approach. And even herbal remedies have been tried.
Right. So the companies, obviously, you know, they're interested in satisfying consumer demand. So they've been taking, you know, they've been moving toward, well, in some cases, they're offering lines of poultry where they can advertise, you know, we never used antibiotics in raising these birds. Purdue actually bought an organic line, Coleman's Natural. And so they took some of the lessons from that organic operation and have been applying them more in their sort of conventional operation to sort of say, okay, how can we keep birds healthy and still not use antibiotics? And they've had various strategies for this. It seems to work reasonably well. And among the tools that they've adopted is the idea of putting in, good bugs, bacteria that are good for you or at least not harmful into the feed. The idea is that they would, if they prosper, then they will sort of crowd out the space for sort of the infectious bugs that you don't want to have in there.
And we are talking about chickens with our guest, Jan Charles. And again, he covers food and farming for NPR. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Dana, I've never been to a chicken, although I grew up in Delaware, I haven't been to a chicken farm in decades now. But I think what's so sort of overwhelming and sort of even hard to understand is just looking at the scale, even looking at that video or other videos of what it looks like inside a poultry barn, I guess. I mean, first of all, they're huge, filled with so many chickens. Some of these places, as you have reported, 1 million eggs every week are produced. It's just the scale of it is just pretty mind-boggling.
Well, it is. But that's that's the way a lot of things have developed,
yeah.
Right? So, I mean, I think people, respond in ambivalent ways to that. People in the industry, obviously, they're in a business and they've gone for maximum efficiency. It's been true in, production of a lot of things, including vegetables. I mean, you look at, you go to a massive, lettuce operation in the Salinas Valley in California or in Mexico. The scale is mind-boggling of that as well. So, I don't know. I mean, are you asking how should we think about this? How
do we
respond
to
it?
I mean, in part, just sort of looking at, what is the life of a chicken?
Yeah. Well, okay. So I grew up on a farm in Pennsylvania. We had a, we had a dairy operation. We had a house full of egg-laying chickens. And one of my jobs as a very young kid was to go out and gather the eggs, right? And there were chickens running around on the floor, piles of dried manure.
Right.
They probably had more space than in these big long houses. They got to go into little dark places and lay their eggs. So I guess, maybe they were happier. How do you measure the happiness
I don't
of
know.
A chicken?
I don't know. I do not know the answer to that.
There are actually people who study this. There's a study going on right now organized and paid for by the egg-laying industry. There has to be some skepticism attached to that, but it's being carried out by these academics at three different universities where they have three different sort of egg-laying systems side by side, commercial scale. One is traditional cages. One is like a bigger cage. They call it enriched cages, where there is a little place for the chickens to go to lay their eggs that's sort of enclosed and so forth. And the other one is free range. And they're trying to measure all kinds of things about chicken behavior and the economics to say, what is better for the chickens and for the farmer?
Well, on that note, Dan Charles, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
One night, Farmer Brown was taking the air. Locked up the barnyard with the greatest of care. Down in the hen house, something stirred when he shouted, "Who's there?" This is what he heard. "There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. So calm yourself and stop that fuss. There ain't nobody here but us. We chickens trying to sleep, and you butt in and hobble, 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 hobble with your chin. There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. You're stomping around
shaking the ground.